Hello, listeners. Welcome to the Book Spider Podcast. This is a podcast with hot, sweaty book loving. So if you don't want to get hot and sweaty with us today, then the discussion we're about to have on the future of literacy may not be for you. I'm joined, as always, by my co-hosts, Hans Berger and Patrick Barney, and today we're discussing Werner Vinge's 2007 sci-fi novel, Rainbow's End. Werner Vinge is sci-fi royalty for his far-flung future hard sci-fi novels, A Fire Upon the Deep and A Deepness in the Sky, which are very different animals from this one, which is inspired by and dedicated to modern information engines like Google and Wikipedia. Rainbow's End is about a near future in which such information engines have synergized with ubiquitous computational and augmented reality technologies to make basically all information available anywhere all the time via multimedia overlays that blur the virtual and the real. People can interact with all the information and media pretty much however they like. The distinction between creators and consumers has eroded away, such that the world as we know it is a bit of a boring canvas upon which these fabricated realities are constantly displayed. Search and analysis and multimodal composition are the new foundational skills taught in school, replacing things like English composition and, dare I say, reading comprehension. While this isn't a totally post-literate future, the preeminence of writing as the means by which we express ourselves and consume art has truly fallen away, leaving our protagonist Robert, a former respected poet rejuvenated by futuristic medicine and trying to find his way in this strange new world, a bit frustrated. The story follows him as he attends school with both AR native children and other old fogies who've had their bodies and faculties restored by technology. They're all getting a crash course in how this near future works, which serves as a convenient on-ramp to Werner Vinge exploring it with us. Mostly, this is a book of grab bag. This is a grab bag of ideas, more or less forced together into a picaresque narrative. Those ideas include Robert learning how to see and contribute to the ubiquitous augmented realities that have replaced traditional literacy and communication technologies, Robert being co-opted into a geopolitical conspiracy to conceal a secret technology that allows people to be brainwashed, the potential emergence of a truly self-aware AI called Rabbit, with unclear values and motivations, or at least I'm not sure at the end whether Rabbit spells are doom or not. One character suggests that he may be a kind of trickster god. Robert, and the last narrative, and this is the one that I'm most interested in, Robert and other students resisting the incineration of an entire library's worth of physical media as an accelerated means to digitize that media and capture it in a massive public database. It is suggested that the database will be used less as a means to distribute those books for people to read them than to make all of human history crawlable and manipulable by the various algorithms and information engines, such as Google and Wikipedia. And I said public, but it's not really that clear. It is suggested that people would have to pay for it. Put simply, though, the books wouldn't be read so much as used as a battery for the creation of media going forward, which I think is pretty resonant with where we find ourselves today. As I said, this last thread is the one that I'm most interested in discussing, in part because Book Spider is a podcast about storytelling, and we've talked a little bit here and there about the state of storytelling and the state of technology and how they intersect today. I have to admit, I'm not super interested in talking about the book Rainbow's End as a crafted thing. As much as I love Vinge for A Fire Upon the Deep, I found a decent amount of this book to be sort of tedious. I don't know if Hans and Patrick agree with me or disagree, but Robert's redemption journey from cartoonishly awful dickhole didn't compel me in the slightest, and something about the geopolitical thriller aspects of the novel also left me kind of bored. Even so, I think there are things to discuss here. The economist George Box famously said of predictive modeling, "All models are wrong, some are useful." Science fiction can care to varying degrees about its fidelity to reality, but Werner Vinge's aim for Rainbow's End was explicit. He was trying to model the near future. More importantly for us, and for what I'd like to talk about today, the book models the rapid proliferation of new multimedia literacies and means for expression against the declining social value of books. I'd like to talk about that today. Last episode, we talked about Galatea 2.2, and we found ourselves talking about more than the kind of prescient aspects of the novel, the craft of the novel, the aesthetics of the novel, even kind of acknowledging that we were impressed by the prescience of the novel. And I'd like to maybe take an opportunity to return to maybe to Galatea 2.2, maybe to some other books that we've read that we've considered prescient, and kind of explicitly talk about prescience in storytelling. So we've called some of the books that we've discussed on this podcast prescient. What makes a book prescient, and is it an accident or a skill to write one? Is there a craft of prescience?
Well, I suppose that what would, what would make a book prescient would be to read it and have a sense that the future it imagined or the things that it saw as being important before they were important resonate with the current moment, right? To read a book and say either this imagined the future that did turn out to exist to one extent to another, or this is aware of, this was aware in its time of themes and trends which did not seem significant then, but which would become, you know, much more significant later. So, you know, we talked about the book Cosmopolis on this podcast, right? And Cosmopolis is centered around a massive financial crash and around a protest against economic inequality. And that was written, I think, in what, like 01, 02? It might even be, I can't remember if it was pre or post 9/11, but it was written years before the 2008 financial crash and the Occupy Wall Street protests. But reading it in 2010, it appeared to be aware of the possibility of, you know, reckless financial engineering vaporizing large amounts of wealth, and it appeared to be very interested in social movements against inequality at a level of interest that you would not have drawn from, you know, normal day-to-day discourse in that time, right? It was interested in those things before they became the thing for the period that they did. So that would be one form of prescience. Not so much predicting the future as being attentive to things which are unimportant at the time of writing or not of primary importance at the time of writing, but which become important later on, right? I guess the other one would be actually predicting significant things that will exist in the world. With Galatea 2.2, of course, the prescient component came from predicting a large language model, text-based generative AI, made from reviewing old text, essentially. And of course, that type of system was eventually invented. And so I think with the one type of prescience, the paying attention to trends, or the first type of prescience, the recognizing important things before they become important, the skill to that really, DeLillo would say at least, is just paying attention, right? Paying true attention to what seems important to you without being influenced by, you know, the kind of tides of attention that go this way and that for reasons that are often not connected to the true importance of the underlying matter. With Galatea 2.2, I would imagine it would just have to do with being someone who is actually truly scientifically literate in a way that most fiction writers are not. And, I mean, Powers, I think, to some extent, happened to get very lucky with being in contact with the right sorts of folks, with the right sorts of ideas, in a way that you couldn't really. You could do the DeLilloian prescience, I think, just by being an attentive, thoughtful citizen. The Powers prescience, I think you would actually need to have a level of scientific intelligence above what almost anybody who's drawn to fiction would have, that of like a Pynchon or a Wallace, you know. And you would need to have, I think, probably a certain amount of contacts in the scientific community. So there seem to me like distinctly different types of prescience. Maybe I'm wrong in saying that, but distinctly different types of prescience with different types of skills involved, and a certain amount of accident as well, right? I think we talked about this a little bit in Galatea 2.2, but like, I think with that novel, in a weird way, it's actually become an albatross to that novel to have been so right about AI, because we read it in 2023 and the rightness of the scientifically predictive part of it threatens to override our sense of all the other important themes and threatens to create an expectation that the novel actually can't satisfy, right? So, like, I think that in terms of delivering other ideas, it's kind of become, in a weird way, a handicap for that novel to have been so right about that one particular aspect. And I think this novel also, in a weird way, I think the closer that we get to the future that it envisions, meaning Rainbow's End now, right? Like, the closer that we get to the future that it envisions, the less readable it will be, the less interesting it will be.
I like that you drew, starting with how you drew a distinction between kind of two forms of prescience. I think I was thinking something similar. In fact, I almost wrote this question or a second follow-up question, kind of distinguishing between the prescience of someone like DeLillo from the prescience of someone like Vinge or Powers. I wasn't necessarily thinking of it exactly the same terms as you are. But it seems like Vinge famously for this novel basically had Google and Wikipedia open and was kind of basically constructing the novel out of, you know, the fragments of different sort of like hot ideas about the future that were sort of circulating at the time. And in a way that feels like it might be more vulnerable to aging than whatever the hell it is DeLillo is doing, which you described as sort of like paying attention to trends. Could you unpack what you mean by trends with DeLillo? I think that that's where, like, it feels like there's a kind of there's like a watershed there that you're getting at, that like DeLillo is paying attention to something else. And I kind of feel that with Richard Powers too, just kind of bouncing to Galatea 2.2, it feels like technology, like old Star Trek or old, you know, like any old sci-fi movie, like weirdly, like they're reflective of the time that they're constructed in. And that type of prescience can almost has a hard time escaping that point in time's vision for the future. And I'm curious, I want to return to that. I don't want to ditch that entirely, but I'm just really interested in what you mean by trends with DeLillo and how that feels different.
Well, I think trend is maybe a tricky word. I don't know if I could have thought of a better one in the moment, but I think with DeLillo, I just meant maybe phenomena would be a better term. Phenomena or possibilities, right? Cosmopolis, as I understand it, was written shortly after a somewhat smaller financial crash and a small recession. And DeLillo happened to see in that phenomenon the possibility of a larger, more significant, more apocalyptic financial crash. And he was probably not familiar with, you know, security-backed, mortgage-backed securities or credit default swaps or the particulars of the kinds of financial instruments that led to the 08 crash. But he was, as it happened, thoughtful enough to see that there was a vulnerability that, you know, was built into the size and complexity of that system. So trend is maybe, I think phenomenon or possibility might be a better word than trend, because trend can be, if anything, I think trend is the opposite of what DeLillo is paying attention to. Trend would suggest something that is by its nature transient, passing, and to some extent arbitrary, right? The term trend suggests the arbitrary, the arbitrary paying of attention to an unworthy thing for a limited period of time in a kind of, you know, chaotic way. And I think what DeLillo is credited with doing, more or less fairly, I mean, he's kind of become the archetype of the prescient novelist, just to an extent that I think maybe kind of might even be a bit overrated. But what DeLillo's credited with doing is ignoring trends in terms of where to pay attention in favor of a more thoughtful sense of what actually, which phenomena and which possibilities actually carry with them, the possibility of importance.
And Patrick, I think you and I read more sci-fi than Hans, and sci-fi is used a lot of the time to actually reflect on now, basically, like, you know, to kind of like take some essential like theme of now and then like either like sort of like allow it to kind of technologically or progress or evolve to its like logical extremes in some sort of like sci-fi future where you can just sort of say like, what if corporations ran everything and there was no state, you know, or, you know, what have you. But basically, often it feels like sci-fi does that. Is there, in your experience, a kind of a craft of sci-fi that is trying to be predictive of the future? Is that not something that you find with sci-fi? This is not a question that I wrote down, but it occurred to me to ask it.
I mean, the example that comes immediately to mind, it's not worried about technology so much, but 1984, you know, is a pretty much.
I'm sorry, 1984? Is that what? Is that a book?
You're hilarious. But yeah, 1984 is trying to predict the future. So
did it do a good job?
I mean, yeah. You said that sometimes novelists like take what they see today and kind of extrapolate from it to predict a future. And yes, 1984 does that. It looked at Stalinism and then extended Stalinism into like a worldwide phenomenon, basically, where essentially every country has its own form of Stalinism and, you know, is Stalinism across the globe.
Well, and Chris, what you had said particularly was novels which look at some specific aspect and extend that to its logical end, right? And I think 1984 obviously looked, as you said, Patrick, looked at, you know, the kind of totalitarianism of Stalinism and took that to its logical end.
Right.
And I think that there's a power in doing that because you create a, like, because 1984 is kind of like maximal Stalinism everywhere,
right,
all the time. I don't think that we're never going to be in a literal 1984 future, because that's like an entire house where every room is painted black, right?
Sure.
And just by the nature of the complexity of the world, you're probably never going to have an entire world where everything is painted entirely Stalinism, because the world is just a more complicated system than that. But what 1984, I think, did was, by isolating and extending that idea, it created a language where aspects of that world could be found in a lot of different things going forward.
Exactly.
Right? It kind of created a, maybe flavor is too reductive a word, but it created a language for identifying trends or things happening. Phenomena, I think. I just was against the word trends a few minutes ago. But when you take, you know, when you're a thoughtful enough writer to take one thing and kind of spin it up to a maximum like that, you create a language where people will see aspects of your thing throughout as long as your work is remembered, or your work will become remembered for people seeing aspects of your thing. A different example maybe would be Snow Crash, right? Mm. Like Snow Crash takes the possibility of virtual reality and spins it up to a kind of logical maximal extreme where everything is people's interaction with virtual reality, right? And now, because it kind of was smart enough to take that one idea, and virtual reality wasn't really a thing at all when Snow Crash was written, to my understanding, right? But like, it still is part of the language of how we think and talk about virtual reality now, right? And so that's maybe a less dire example, you know. And I suppose what Vinja, to kind of focus on Rainbow's End, right, like part of what Vinja is doing is taking, you could argue, I suppose, maybe taking the idea of technological, the ways that technology evolves our experience of literacy, right? He's taking that, spinning that to a logical extreme in a way where I probably will think of this book in relationship to anything that I see in the future that has to do with advances in the relationship between technology and literacy. I don't think that it's doing it with the scale or the skill of a 1984 or a Snow Crash, but it's compelling, I think, in its vision.
Either I don't think this novel is extremely prescient, or I don't think that it's what it's looking at doesn't. I know that you disagree with this, Chris, because one of your questions kind of gives that away. But I'm actually a bit, miffed isn't the word, but I'm surprised that you don't want to talk about Craft, because Craft, I think, is like the novel's failures at Craft seem interesting to me, like something worth talking about. And but
sure.
You said,
I mean, I don't make the rules. I just wrote the questions. So like if I think that if you're going to go into like, because this novel is very, very much trying to be like, hey, what's coming? And I think that, you know, 17 years have passed. It's fair to judge it to some extent just based on how well it predicted those things. And but I also think that it's fair to, it's a crafted thing. We should be able to talk about the craft of it too. I just didn't, you know, I was pretty disappointed rereading it, and I didn't want to spend too much time dumping on it. But if there's some inroad to talking about like the craft that is interesting, then I'm definitely open to it.
Particularly if you think that the craft is an impediment to the expression of the theme or the exploration of its ideas about the future.
Well, actually, yeah. Mm. I think that he could have tackled the theme, the idea that technology... the basic idea is that technology is going to change, and because technology mediates how we interact with reality... how we interact with reality is going to change, and that's going to have benefits and advantages, right? Like, this might be a theme that we could get from the novel. But I think that the novel would be a lot better if we didn't have this geopolitical thriller stuff, and we just...
Oh yeah, that's
yeah,
boring.
It was the geopolitical thriller stuff was super boring. Rabbit was kind of cool as like this trickster god idea, but really what we needed here was just a character study of Robert Goo, who you know, he's rejuvenated from Alzheimer's with the Ven Kurosawa treatment, but it brings him back, but it doesn't bring back his poetic gift. So he's forced into a new life where he doesn't matter and he's not special. And a deeper character study of him, I think, could have done a lot better at exploring the themes that Vinji wanted to explore. Although you know, and maybe you could still go either way. You could still, like, if you wanted to kind of shit on technology, you could make it a really tragic story where he's not able to cope and he ends up blowing his brains out or something. Or if you don't want to shit on technology, you just want to talk about, you want to be more neutral about the fact that it changes, then you can make it happy, you know. But that's mostly what I had to say about Kraft.
No, I totally agree. I think that, like, I think that the story here is old farts out of time, given, you know, kind of a sort of a literary device-y, like, stranger in a strange land, like, let's see this new world with different eyes, with eyes that, you know, we share because we're from their time. And that new world is confronting shifts in literacy that basically make it not a big deal to just incinerate all the books ever, mm-hmm. right? Like, there's not really, like, a reason for books to exist in this future. And, you know, there's, like, kind of, like, set pieces for very interesting conversations about the values of books. Like, there's a conversation about the value of sort of, like, walking through stacks of books and not knowing exactly what you're looking for. And, but, you know, like, there might be values to that, but then, you know, at the end, you see that, like, they can reconstruct that. Basically, the books don't even have to be real to be able to be interacted with as books. You know, you can walk through empty hallways and basically project augmented reality books, you know, onto the walls. And, you know, that to me is fascinating.
Agreed.
That to me is, like, the thing that resonates. It's the thing that feels like it's the most human concern. It's the thing that I'm concerned about. And I agree. Like, the rest of it is just not very compelling. And I think that, I don't know, like, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to throw Vinji under the bus. I don't think that he's a character study type writer.
Well, sure.
I just don't know that he's capable of that type of craft. And he found himself in a position when he's writing hard sci-fi about the deep, deep future. There's something that allows for his particular craft to really shine there. And this book, you know, won a lot of awards. And I remember reading it and being kind of dismayed by aspects of it. I even though kind of remember after reading it the second time, I remembered the experience of it the first time thinking, like, ah, this book is just okay. So, I had forgotten that. I had forgotten that when I recommended we read it again.
What I want to know, Chris, is this, you know, you mentioned, like, you're worried about what this novel projects about literacy, and you also say that we're facing a crisis of literacy right now, which, you know, I don't necessarily disagree with, but, like, I would like your thoughts on that. But I also wanted to ask or say, it doesn't seem like these people don't read. Granted, technology has changed how reading works and how what it means to be literate, but these people still read. They still you know, maybe are you concerned that are we dismayed that the idea of literature itself is falling away? Is that our main concern here?
No, that's a good question, Patrick. I think so. I'm going to tell a bit of a story, and I'm sorry. I hope I don't end up talking too much, but I did just attend a conference that was explicitly about how we should teach with AI in higher education. Mm-hmm. And that conference was a bit of artifice of self-selection, because basically everyone there is the most open to the application of generative AI. It's called generative AI, like ChatGPT, DALL-E, Claude 2, Pi, but it's not specifically just generative. Actually, one of the primary functions of it is to basically provide analysis and kind of some consolidation or application on your behalf, so you can ask it to do stuff for mm-hmm. you that includes the type of analysis of, say, a completely digitized database of media. And that's kind of suggested in Rainbow's End, that like all the books are digitized, not necessarily, you know, people will read them, but the excellent thing about basically capturing all of human history, all of the media from human history, and putting it in a big old database, is the computational algorithms that study and sample and jump in, and like if you were to construct an avatar that is, you know, Hermione Granger, you know, you can ask the computer to do that, and it would just sort of put it together for you. You wouldn't even have to have read the books. You'd just have to know them. You'd have to know, like, the kind of symbol that figure represents in literature, or, when it is accessible to these tools that we use to create and analyze on our behalf, we don't necessarily need to read them anymore. We can. It doesn't mean that like we won't. It just means that their function is not like primarily first to be read in order to be understood. Their function is to exist in a space that the tools that we actually use to interact with the world can draw from as needed. And I don't necessarily think that's like, I don't think that's a dystopian future necessarily. I don't think that it's like bad, but I do actually think it's somewhat prescient given my experience at that conference and what people are sort of like talking about when it comes to how we're going to ask students to read and write in the future. Like, there's not really any way to have a student read something and then write something about it and assess whether they've actually read and written about it. Like, that's going away. Like, that's not actually going to be a thing.
Well,
anymore.
I think we can assess whether they've written it. I mean, I'm almost positive I've had students use ChatGPT to like write poems, and I've called them out on this, like, and the reason I think that we can assess it is because you sample their work, that's, you know, you make sure that you get a piece of work that they have definitely written, and you compare it to ChatGPT, and ChatGPT will be more scholarly, I guess, or
it's not that different from how we usually pick up on plagiarism,
right?
When we catch that, right? Like, you have a certain amount of what the student has written that you know is not pulled from a book or another paper, and then when they submit something that is drastically different in tone and style,
right,
you go, hey, where'd this come from, right? I wonder if like it might be that the I mean, that's easier to do, I think, in an in-person class where you can have somebody like write on a piece of paper before your eyes. I think like the increasing mediation and remoting of at least, you know, 100, 200 level classes may
make it harder,
make it more difficult to ever get something that you're sure wasn't run through ChatGPT or some descendant of that.
Yeah, I would say that that's part of it. And also these large language models are evolving rapidly enough that, and not just their evolution, but the evolution of how people use them. You can ask them to write. You can give them a piece of your writing and ask it to write in your voice. And they're becoming more trainable over time with individual users. I guess like what you're talking about, Patrick, is a window that is going to go away.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Absolutely.
And so literacy, and I'm kind of, I don't want to just get this stuck in education and the crisis of education as it faces literacy. I think that literacy in general is going to change. And, I guess like, you know, Patrick, it sounds like your take on Rainbow's End was that it was optimistic. I think that Vinci is inherently optimistic about, he's an inherently optimistic futurist. And so like I'm not always carried along by his optimism, but it sounds like maybe that resonates with an optimism for you. And did you find Rainbow's End prescient in this particular, potentially prescient in this particular like dimension of the novel? Is there some way you can talk about like your feelings about the future of literacy using Rainbow's End as a scaffold?
So the way you just spoke about it, how like that window where we can tell that students have written something is going away. If that's true, and I think, you know, I think that's a good point. You're probably right. If that's true, then, you know, things are going to change as we know it. Literature is going to be different. It may go away forever. And that's a tragic, horrible thing to contemplate. So I definitely wouldn't share Vinji's optimism. Like, it's like watching, have either of you guys seen the movie Her? Okay, so I really dislike that movie because it is optimistic about AI, and I'm like, this is not how it's going to go down, where, you know, we end up, you know, AI like becomes its own intelligence and does its own thing, and it doesn't really harm us. Like, it helps us. We befriend it, so to speak. I don't know everything about how AI is going to go down, but, you know, just paying attention, like, there's, technology does change us. It does change how we function. Certain lifestyles and ways of living are going to go away. You know, you can know that from reading Technopoly by, I forget what his name is. Neil Postman. Like, that's a point that he makes. You know, when some blacksmiths, when the automobile was invented, were like, oh yeah, this is going to be awesome for me. Like, I'm gonna have new business. And no, your entire way of life is going away. And that may be true for literature, and that's a bad thing. But like so much bad shit is already around the corner. It's kind of like, you know, we're fucked either way. Like, we're going to be we're definitely going to be fucked. I don't know. Is that all right?
Like, whatever the prediction is, if it fucks us, Patrick thinks it's prescient.
Yeah. Like, it's... it. Vinji is not prescient because he's optimistic about it. And if he were pessimistic, if this novel ended with, like, a bunch of zombies who are controlled by their government, or, you know, basically there are a bunch of conspiracy theorists or something like that, then it would be prescient.
I want to push back. It was just like, you don't think that there's, like, we're biased on behalf of traditional literacies. Like, I think that that's safe to say. Like, we value the novel, we value the book of poetry, we value writing in general as a means of expression and an art, high art form, and I don't think that Vinji, like, specifically, like, I'm performing a little bit of, like, apologia analysis, where I'm connecting some of the dots that he's not, but, like, you know, the way there is, like, some representation of what we call generative AI in the book, in that, you know, to basically create and to participate in this world where you have access to all of the information that you could ever, you know, want, you know, the tools for creation have been made simple enough that people can just sort of imagine, you know, a T-Rex or whatever and just generate it, or a T-Rex with a, you know, wearing a cape, you know, flying through sky like space, you know, like mm-hmm. Superman. Like, the ways that things can be just sort of different symbols and images can be compressed in this very postmodern way, where you no longer have to have a relationship with the core thing that's visualized or scripted, or, you know, you can just sort of construct it. You know, I that does alarm me, but I wonder if what it alarms in me is, you know, my own attachment to a very different form of literacy. And, you know, there might be something positive about that. You know, there might be quite a bit positive about that future. I don't know that people stop reading, though. Like, I think that people will continue to write and read. I just don't know. I don't know. Well, it feels a bit like Calvin Ball jump this far into the future, but it feels not too far into the future for me these days.
Let me compare some of my own experience. So, last time for the Galatea podcast, I mentioned in the intro that I have one more master's degree than each of you has. Now, I said that just to be funny, just to blah blah blah, and like, it's funny because I don't like that second master's degree I got feels like complete bullshit to me. Like, I don't use it. I'm in a completely different job now. The degree is called professional writing, but, you know, it might as well have just said been a degree in, like, general design principles, general multimedia design principles, basically. So, you know, you took, like, courses in how to use Photoshop. You took principles of design courses for understanding how to make good, like, flyers and posters and whatnot. You took courses in creating websites, right? And basically, you know, the... Basically, I felt like the name of the degree, a master's in professional writing, is pretty much a misnomer and misleading because, you know, like for my final project, my final like capstone project, I was part of a team that designed a website. And the amount of writing was a few paragraphs. My capstone project was like we did a veterinarian's clinic or something, and you know, it was pure garbage. You know, what we turned in was crap. We didn't have a great, we didn't have a really cooperative client. It was a real veterinarian's clinic that we were trying to design a website for. And, you know, that's not necessarily their fault, but the point I'm making is it was just, like, I have a glimpse of this new type of literacy that you're talking about, I think, Chris. And I would say that if this new type of literacy replaces literature, then we lose something a lot. We lose something huge. And if it's just kind of like another type of literacy where literature isn't replaced, then it's a shallower, less interesting, stupider form of literacy, and that's bad too.
You sound like Robert Goo.
I probably do.
I mean, I think that we're we as three individuals, and you might be a bit behind us here, Chris, because of the age spread, but we as three individuals are reaching a point where we are going to feel alienated we're going to feel alienated by what happens in the greater world. We're going to feel alienated by cultural trends. The things that we care about will go away. Yeah, well, yeah, and I think all of, you know, of course you do. And I do to a great extent as well, right? We're reaching an age where the things that we care about are going to go away. And I don't think that we're special or unique in that regard. And I think that lots of things have been, you know, it makes me think a little bit about, and this is kind of a maybe not a great example, but it's like the difference between an abacus and a calculator, right? Or between being able to really work out complex arithmetic on paper and relying on a calculator. At some point, there's no, to us, with our relative lack of fondness for abaci and complex arithmetic, like, there's no loss in just everybody uses a calculator, you know? But there's a certain kind of beauty in somebody using an abacus to do complex arithmetic. There's a certain kind of, there's something admirable about the ability to work out complex arithmetic on paper. And obviously, like, arithmetic, I think personally, is a one millionth as expressive and rich and varied a world as written language, right? But I think that, you know, there's kind of an equivalency, maybe. And it is, it's just what's going to happen, you know? I mean, the things that are important to us will wither and die as the things that have been important to basically everyone ever have withered and died, at least since the beginning of maybe, I don't know, since the, say, the 1700s, right? Maybe before the 1700s, probably most people everywhere actually lived in a functionally unchanging world, leaving aside, you know, the possibility of violent catastrophe or plague, right? But leaving aside, like, destructive catastrophe, maybe most people could believe that whatever was meaningful and important to them would survive unchanged over generations within memory and within anticipation. But that's just not the world that anyone has lived in for a couple centuries, if not longer. And it's probably, I mean, I like material comfort. I like shelter. I like not being exposed to the elements. I like eating when I want to eat. And I suppose, you know, those things are all connected to industrialized society and that kind of like churn of value is connected to industrialized society too. And, you know, I mean, I think the things that are, I certainly agree with you, Patrick, that, you know, I mean, I think inevitably literacy, as the three of us have understood and experienced it, will be lost, right?
Right.
And maybe kids will still read Harry Potter. But I think like the level of, I think maybe kids will still read Harry Potter, but I don't think adults will still read Don DeLillo, basically, right? Like, and yeah, it's terribly unfortunate. At some point, I don't know that it's helpful to linger on it, right? I mean, I think all that I can really do is try to prevent the erosion in my own self and life of those values and try to model those values for anybody who might be looking. And I think the more time that I spend, you know, beating my chest and wailing over the existence of TikTok, the less I'm going to achieve anything.
Do you hate TikTok?
Meaningful. Of course I do. I mean, I don't need to tell you that I do. but yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Patrick. And also, for the most part, I suppose I try to avoid thinking about it in the kind of maximalist, catastrophic language that you described it in. Not because I think that's inaccurate, more because I think it's not
utilitarian. Well, it is so depressing, you know? And there is utility in, like, when you can't change a thing, there's some benefit to not, like, wringing your hands over it. You know, there's some benefit to trying to live your best life without, like, agonizing over the fact that, you know, something is going to see the end of its life.
I do think that, boy, it makes you wonder in a way, like, and this is going to get away from the really anything directly that we've been talking about other than just media and technology, but like, I was thinking the other day that if I live, and maybe I've told you guys this, it's kind of mundane because it's just math, but like, if I live as long as my grandfather lived, then there's going to be a time when all my favorite music from the 70s will be 100 years old, right? Dark Side of the Moon will be 100 years old. Close to the Edge will be 100 years old. The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway will be 100 fucking years old, right? Red by King Crimson will be 100 years old. In my own lived experience. And, you know, that music seems still to this day so weird and arcane and futuristic and like something from another universe and like something from always kind of the future, right? And and realistically, for the most part, it's probably going to be just kind of, it'll be there if anybody wants it, but it'll be buried. It'll be just kind of out in the realm of things that exist that are untouched and unexperienced. In, again, you know, when I'm my grandfather's age sitting in some nursing home while a robot flips me over so I don't get bed sores.
That was a funny image.
And it makes me wonder, you know, what exists now that I, what existed in my grandfather's time that I am not experiencing that has that quality, right? Is it something that I can never see through his eyes? I mean, he wasn't a very, maybe not him personally because he wasn't literate and he wasn't artistic, but like someone who was me when my grandfather was 25, you know, what were they thrilled by that I cannot access?
Well, what year was your grandfather 25?
The 40s?
I mean, yeah. Probably tons of forms of music. There are probably communal aspects that are no longer accessible, you know, like the way communities were shaped and how they functioned, you know, like...
I guess maybe it's limiting of me to think of that as being something that would exist in the world of recorded music or books, right? Like, I mean, I don't think that I'm going to get that feeling from Glenn Miller,
right?
You know? Maybe it's more to do with like his relationship to agriculture.
Yeah, it could be.
Which I will never have and couldn't. And, you know, if I tried to have it, all I would do is make both myself and the cows unhappy.
Is there a, this is the last question, is there a story, is there something if you had your druthers to write a prescient novel about?
Well, I'm hoping I already did it, and I'm revising it currently.
I think that the extent to which kind of like the atomization, like everybody was getting more distant from each other, more alienated from each other before COVID, right? And the extent to which COVID produced like this sort of final death stroke of atomization and solitude, I think that that story, I think that that's secretly the most important thing happening right now. I went to a wedding yesterday, and it was a small wedding. I'm not even sure I was invited. It was somebody I knew, and my wife was the photographer. So I just assumed that I would be invited to this wedding because, you know, I knew him and he came to my wedding and Lowen, they'd hired Lowen to shoot it. And I was asking Lowen, hey, you know, like, can you send me the address of the venue? Because I don't think I got an invitation or anything. And she was like, what makes you think they want you to come? And I was just like, oh my gosh, maybe I'm not invited to this wedding, you know, but I'd already kind of set the day aside for it. So I put on a nice shirt and said, fuck it, and got in the car. And I got there and it was a very small wedding and none of our other mutual friends were there. And I was like, I don't think they thought I was going to come to the wedding. They were nice about it. They were gracious about it, you know, but there were a couple people there. There were a couple people there that I knew tangentially from work and they were just so terrified. Right. Because they had just not like they work 100% remote. They just don't really see people. And they were. You could tell that they were just it was a married couple and they had a couple of kids and you could tell that they were all just they wanted to crawl out of their own skin, you know, being all of a sudden around all these people when they just weren't. And I think there are a great number of people that's kind of like a small, funny version of that phenomenon. But I think the extent to which, at least in like industrial Western society, or at least in the United States, you know, the extent to which we are all just alone an enormous percentage of the time is, I think, actually kind of, if you leave aside, I think leaving aside environmental degradation and AI, I think that is the most important thing that's happening right now. And I don't know how to tell a story about it. I don't know how I'd write a novel about it. And I don't know if it would be better served as something that you approach now with psychological realism, or if it's something that you would try to extend to a logical end in a sci-fi text. Mm. But
that's super interesting. I wish you would write that novel because it'd be good, though. I know you. Yeah. You aren't like on the writing train too much anymore, but I would be. That's a good idea. It's a real good idea.
Well, I got to finish a couple albums first.
That is a good idea, and you know, my suggestion, Hans, is to take what you just said and write it out and plug it into ChatGPT.
Oh,
just
yeah. That's a good idea.
Thank you guys so much for talking a little bit about Rainbow's End. I apologize for picking it. I don't really recommend anyone read it. I audibled to it actually in the middle of Galatea 2.2. I was like, hey, you know what? I kind of, you know, there was that book that was about, you know, the immediate future. And I remember being about literacy. And I'm happy to have had the conversation that we had today, though. I think that was fun. But I'm not going to recommend the book.
I think it's an interesting novel. I don't mind that I read it. I mean, as the one person who knew nothing about Vinja,
I didn't know anything about
Vinja. I'm not resentful that I read it.
No, oh, I mean, oh, okay. Chris, you had recommended A Fire Upon the Deep, but I haven't. I haven't gone to
A Fire Upon the Deep is a masterpiece. It's great. I
think this novel's it's a failure, but it's an interesting failure. I mean, I think it's a failure in a pretty obvious. like, it's very easy to pin down why it's a failure, right? Like, it has three interesting ideas, right? Like, I think the AI thing is interesting, the literacy thing is interesting, and the idea of how security is maintained in 20 or 30 years in the future, I think, is actually interesting. Potentially interesting, right? And it has those three interesting ideas, and it's too interested in each of them to let any of them go. And I think the fact that they all have to fight for oxygen ends up ruining the overall project. But, I mean, I think it's an intriguing failure, and it did. I mean, it is kind of thought-provoking in its way. I'm not mad that I read it.
Well, what are we reading next?
We are reading, and I don't have a great connection, actually. I don't have a great connection here because I have not yet read this novel. It's really more just, honestly, like, I've had it sitting on my shelf for a while, and I've been meaning to get around to it. We're reading The Famished Road by Ben Oakley.
Never heard of it.
Yeah, honestly, he had a story in The New Yorker a year or two ago that I really, really, really enjoyed. And I looked him up, and this appeared to be his best regarded novel and kind of his, like, particular classic. He's a Nigerian author. It's set in Nigeria in the 80s. Written, I believe, in Nigeria in the 80s as well. So arguably post-colonial, I guess. I'd imagine you could put it in that theoretical framework, though I haven't read it yet, so I can't say for sure. I don't see how you wouldn't, but post-colonial magical realism is my rough understanding of what it is. But
all right,
I may revise that in 2 weeks when I've actually read the fucking thing.
Well, everyone, you heard it here. We're going to read The Famished Road by Ben Oakley. Thank you to my co-hosts, Patrick Barney and Hans Berger. Until next time, guys.